People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by FoundItemClothing.com. Check out their Cthulhu slippers and cool cult film t-shirts. Edited and produced by D.B. Spitzer. Featuring Sarah Fee and D.B. Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. PGTTCM is part of the Dark Mists Network. Check out all the cool podcasts that we like at darkmyths.org. Subscribe where you subscribe. Like where you like. Rate where you rate. We recommend podbean.com and Apple Podcasts as well. Find PGTTCM on social media at PGTTCM and on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. If you want to donate, go to the Patreon button on pgttcm.podbean.com or paypal.me/pgttcm. All donations receive an on-air congratulations. Shop at pgttcm.threadless.com or pgttcm.com at the shop. PGTTCM is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos, weird fiction, the gothic literary tradition, classic sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. Thank you. On with the show.
Section 16 of Tales of the Uneasy by Violet Hunt, read by Lisa Reichert. The Tiger Skin, Part 5. The shower was over, and the sun had come out and sent warm rays across the worm-eaten floor, the floor whereon in the old days the feudal servants of the manor house had slept, weary feet to weary feet, fastened in all night by their lord, with no egress save by the little locked door at the foot of the staircase. The lord of old dared not leave his slaves free to murder their taskmaster in his sleep. There may have been at that time about 100 healthy farmhands keeping each other warm and their spirits up through the long night with jests and storytelling. Now this enormous garret held but one sickly, fearful, solitary child. Oh, who had done this? His head swam with dreadful certainties. A great bluebottle flew in at the window and buzzed in and out of the rafters over Mary's head. She was past noticing it, but it irritated Ensor, and he wanted to get up and chase it away. But he could not bear to deposit the child on the filthy palliasse again. The same with a cockroach that made blundering rushes from one joist to another of the decayed ribs of the flooring. There was probably vermin in that bed, and on the child even, but he was past caring. He could not beat his breast. Mea culpa! Mea culpa! Mea maxima culpa! Or tear his hair. His hands were tied, occupied with the task they should have set themselves long months agone. The work to which his downpressed heart had all along instigated him. But in this moment he expiated fully what he described to himself as his rotten carelessness, his wicked, easy-going acceptance of Adelaide's excuses, his shameful apathy in the face of the cruel crime that was being enacted in his house. In Adelaide's house, indeed, but the shame was his. Here was a helpless child, dying under his roof of neglect, or worse, and he had had the face to stand before that committee, composed of decent people, and had been puzzled by their quite natural behavior. They were unfriendly, disgusted, outraged by his pusillanimity, of which they probably had an inkling, or more than an inkling. What about those boys looking over the wall? He had expostulated with the committee for admitting an unpleasant work of fiction into their list, a solecism at worst. He was thinking of Phyllis's morals, whilst Mary starved. He knew now what Mrs. Marrable had meant, that harridan in the right, dying of neglect and worse. His hand stole towards the open front of the child's nightgown. With sudden resolve, he turned her body quite round on his knee and pushed the garment down to her middle. Yes, the scars that play such an important part in the evidence when these sort of cases come before the court were all there, fresh and old scars, deep and superficial, healed, ill-healed, and suppurating. He turned the body round again and felt Mary's pulse. It seemed to him to be almost non-existent. Another long 10 minutes, savage, agonizing, interminable. He knew nothing about it, but he wished the doctor would come. The nurse had probably not been able to catch him before he saw Phyllis, and had had to wait to waylay him until his official visit was over. And as the child lay across his knee, to all appearances comatose, something gray and loathsome did crawl out from the screwed black hair onto the forehead. He pulled out his handkerchief from his breast coat pocket. He felt no sense of disgust to weaken his efficiency. Such things are. It was all part of the horror that had surely now culminated and left him seared and stunned, shamed and blighted. The child sighed, and with a pathetic hint of the baby ways that had been scorched and made to perish out of her, crept closer into his embrace. Her sigh may have been one of relief. Ensor fondly hoped it. The blue bottle buzzed. The black beetle looked out again from the crinkled folds of the Daily Telegraph which Ensor had flung down. He did not move. He hardly thought. He was conscious only of the child nestling in his arms, as if he were its newfound father. And a peace was his, a peace he had never known, as if his soul had at last found its billet. When Nurse Ferrier came up at last with the doctor, he smiled. "Do what you can for her, doctor," he said pleadingly. "Why wasn't I called before?" Hodgson began angrily. Nurse Ferrier touched his arm. Ensor saw it. The doctor imperiously pulled the duster out of the window hole to make more light for himself, and returning, laid the child down on the wretched pallet and methodically examined her. The examination over, he gently pulled the shawl into position so as to cover her, and rose from his knees. "Mr. Ensor, I must see Mrs. Ensor about this," he said gravely. On the way down the narrow flight of stairs, Ensor summoned breath to ask a question. "Is she dying?" "Probably," was the doctor's curt reply, and it was all he would vouchsafe. Adelaide was in the hall and came to meet them. "Where have you been, doctor?" she asked suspiciously. Her eyes fell and rested scornfully on her husband. "Walt, you look pretty bad. Go and get yourself a whiskey and soda."
"Yes, do,"
said Hodgson. He turned to Adelaide with a rough dignity of manner. "Mrs. Ensor, it is my duty to tell you both that if that child upstairs dies, I shall refuse a certificate and order an inquest." Wald almost admired Adelaide now for her pluck. A spasm of annoyance, no more, crossed her face, and turning, she led the way across the hall towards her morning room. She said over her shoulder, "She's only shamming. It seems to me you want to drink too, doctor. That was thunder we heard just now. It's upset you both. Wald, be good enough to send Nurse Ferrier straight to me here. I'm going to sack her." She went into the portion of the hall that was screened off, and seeing that both the men disregarded her gesture of invitation to go further and stayed in the main hall, she shrugged her shoulders and flung herself onto her tiger skin, turning her back. Motionless. The doctor looked at Ensor and spoke meditatively.
"In Mrs. Ensor's present state," he murmured, "perhaps I had better speak to you, Mr. Ensor."
"Certainly," Ensor said, leading the way into the dining room.
"I may say before you speak that I know nothing of this. But that's no matter," he went on. "The blame is mine."
He rang the bell.
"Ask Gertrude to come to me here," he said to a maid who appeared at the service door at the end.
The girl hesitated. She had something in her hand.
"What is it? What is it?" Ensor asked testily.
"I was going to show the doctor, sir, what Mary had to eat."
She held out a plate for their inspection, with some toast rinds and the remains of dripping fat adhering to the sides.
In her other hand, she held a mug into which Dr. Hodgson peered. A concoction of tea leaves.
She was fed, sir, worse than a dog, the girl continued volubly. Biscuits was bought for him. She never complained, not she. Too frightened for that, for if she did, she got the stick.
Who beat her? Ensor asked furiously.
Mrs. Ensor, till she got ill. She used to take the poker to her. That's all the marks on her back now. You've seen him, Doctor?
Yes, yes. Hold your tongue now,
Hodgson said. He turned to Ensor, who stood quietly beside him, receiving the unbearable douche of the servant girl's revelations with such fortitude as he was able to muster.
If the child dies, there will have to be an inquest. I must give the nurse some directions. Where is she? Be off. Back to your work, he bade the kitchen maid, and ask nurse to come to me.
Nurse Ferrier, quiet, composed, unsmiling, appeared in the doorway, and Ensor scrutinized her face for news as eagerly as if he had not possessed the gift of speech.
Is she dead?
He at last breathed. No, sir, no, she answered kindly after a pause, recalled, as it were, from other thoughts. Ensor did not catch the almost imperceptible shake of the doctor's head that came hard upon her words. The nurse continued softly, appealing to her chief.
We won't let her die, will we, doctor?
Not if we can help it, he replied gruffly. Get yourself a drink, Mr. Ensor, and buck up now. There will be a lot to do presently.
Ensor slowly walked away, and the doctor turned to the nurse.
I wouldn't give a farthing for that child's life, you know, he said. Have you brought her down?
Yes, she's in the spare bedroom. Mr. Ensor would wish her to have the best of everything, I think.
Her long, drooping eyes were raised to the doctor's for a moment. She wanted to talk to him, and he knew it. But he did not, at this juncture, care to throw any deductions he might have made from facts patent to both of them into the common fund, and he interposed the chill of professional etiquette between himself and her possible confidences. He walked quickly, meditating the while, down the narrow flagged way that led from the house door to the gate in the wall, where his horse was being held for him by James, the half-idiotic manservant, the only male creature, excepting her husband, whom Adelaide would tolerate about the place. Today, however, expecting as usual to have the whole of the path to himself, the doctor almost hustled a person of quite a different type from James's, a smart, slight, efficient young fellow, slipping briskly up to the house. Hodgson apologized. The stranger, who was dressed in some sort of uniform, looked curiously at him, as if about to speak, but thought better of it and passed on. After some little delay, Gertrude came to her master in the dining room, where he had summoned her. She looked hurried, portentous, but at the same time armed with the indifference of fat people. Her wide apron was covered here and there with spots of gravy or blood. He supposed she had been drawing chickens or killing them. Her bib was pinned up at the corners over her ample bosom. She had no right to have a breast. She had no right to be made like a woman. He loathed her, the agent of Adelaide's system, the janissary who, with fiendish personal lust of cruelty, had brutally carried out his poor wife's unholy theories. And all the while, the uncomfortable consciousness was his that, whatever his contempt of Gertrude, it was equaled by her scorn of him. This abominable woman looked down on him. In her eyes lurked the conception of him as something mean and pitiful and likable. Yes, she awarded him a certain amount of good-humored commiseration, and she was his cook.
I couldn't come before, she said sturdily. I've been up with Phyllis, who's left all alone because of this business. Be done as soon as you can, sir, for I want to get back to the poor child. You will tell me before you go, please, how long this has been going on. How long have you been neglecting and ill-treating your own child?
The woman sneered.
Married, do you mean? Well, you see, Mary all along was only allowed to be here, as you might say, through the kindness of Miss Adelaide, as being her cook's child.
She continued, as if repeating a lesson learned by heart. Miss Adelaide, Mrs. Ensor,
has always been very good to me, and I've been the same to her. But it stands to reason that Mrs. Ensor wasn't going to bring up my bastard like a lady. Mary Adelaide, that's her name, had to be trained to be a servant and work for her bread, like her mother's always done. And when she didn't work, she had to be beat.
And what was the work you set a child of 10 to do? Ensor asked, striving at calmness.
Child of 10? She's 15, same as Phyllis. Well, let me see. She cleaned the silver, setting down to it every day, and swept a room, or maybe two, and did down the steps, and her own sewing and mending.
And what did she have to eat?
What the girl showed you, Gertrude said, throwing up her chin in sullen pride of evil-doing. Scraps what was left over from the day before. That is, if I would remember to give it to her. And she never reminded me. Too soft. Shameful lazy she was, too, and one had to take a stick or a poker to her to make her bustle. Whoop! Go long! Was all the kind words she got, and a neat cut across her back. She was that lazy, they never had time to heal before there was a new stripe laid over the last one.
My God! A young child! He covered his face with his hands.
Gertrude regarded him. Some shifting of values took place in her heavy brain. She came a step nearer, and her voice lost its tone of coarse bravado.
You must know, sir, I had my orders.
Your orders, woman. Your orders to play the murderess. You, the unnatural mother.
You may look a little nearer home for the unnaturalness, if you'll have it. Some folks is very blind and deaf, too.
What do you mean? His tone was violent. The cook said patiently, raising her apron to her face,
I'll say no more, sir. I must be going.
Stop! Cried Ensor furiously. You brute!
Call me brute, sir, Gertrude answered almost modestly.
Then her temper rose. She flushed.
Do you know who's a-waiting for me in my back kitchen where I told him to stop? She said passionately. No one won't go away from here, mister, I said, so long as I give you my word. But I'd something I'd like to say to Mr. Ensor first, before he saw him, I said, and it would be best for all parties if I could get it said. So he let me come, though he's not a-going back without seeing you.
She produced a dirty card from the bosom of her dress and handed it to her master. The nurse met the doctor on the doorstep when he came back half an hour later. Her manner was instructive as she came forward, her finger on her lip, and he knew what she would tell him.
Mary's gone, doctor, half an hour ago, and Mrs. Ensor has bolted herself into her bedroom and won't answer to anyone. I'm afraid she's bad, and... She dropped her voice. There's a man shut in the library with Mr. Ensor. Here's what he brought. I found it on the floor of the dining room just now.
She produced the card, stained with blood where Gertrude's fingers had grasped it.
Only fowls, she said apologetically.
The doctor took it.
The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, Inspector G.W. Kelson, he exclaimed. That's Mrs. Marrable. She said she was going to put the Society onto them.
She's a bit late, the nurse said.
By half an hour.
He echoed her as they went in together. You never heard anything like it, the nurse continued as they proceeded upstairs. Gertrude the cook has been telling me, and who she is and all. They've just killed her, by inches.
Not by inches, by yards, corrected Dr. Hodgson. He was very indignant. The child's back is covered with unhealed sores, suppurating. She doesn't weigh more than 48 pounds. 62 she should have. Systemic neglect and outrageous cruelty. They'll have to answer for it.
Mr. Ensor knew nothing of it, I'll swear, the nurse said quickly.
Yes, his wife leads him by the nose, replied Hodgson.
She's a caution, exclaimed the nurse with virulence.
And she'll get off because of her condition. They always admit that.
When it's her own child, doctor? Of course, you know it's her own child?
I suspected it, he said quietly. They had come into the great, wide, lightly papered spare bedroom with three tall windows looking out over the gray gravel sweep in front of the house. The windows were wide open. The gardener could be heard sharpening his old-fashioned instrument, ready for cutting the scrap of lawn beyond the gravel. Professionally, perfunctorily, the doctor looked at and examined what lay on the bed. Then, while the nurse finished her work, he strolled to a window and stared out, waiting to see the master of the house, whose voice could be heard urgently talking in the room immediately below. The nurse, dabbing sponges in hot water, going backwards and forwards with towels, talked. She had not talked for weeks. "The likeness," she said. "Don't you see it's strong? Now she's dead, doctor. I must say I noticed it the very first moment he came up into the garret, where they had put the poor child away to sleep, or to die, as it happened. Nobody'd been near her for days. Gertrude thought Mrs. Ensor had, and she thought, God knows what she thought. She shuddered. There wasn't so much as a jug of water there. Mrs. Ensor hoped Mary would die, and Gertrude didn't care. She's a regular bad one. She was cook to Mrs. Ensor before she married, and had a baby there, and Miss Adelaide's father, he was a doctor, and he gave her a certificate of death. He was a wicked old man, by all accounts. So when Miss Adelaide got into trouble, this woman helped her. All the while she talked, she was busying herself about the wretched little body of Mary. The doctor stood at his post near the window, waiting for Mr. Ensor's visitor to go, listening to the nurse's talk as he lightly slashed his top boots with his riding whip and decided what he would do. He liked Ensor and wanted to make it easy for him. "And," Nurse Ferrier continued, "she says they bought this house with its high walls all round because Miss Adelaide didn't care to be seen about much. She was ashamed, not so much because she had had a baby without being married, but because it was such a wretched little specimen. She called herself Mrs. Dibben. That was the name of Gertrude's man. He was a prize fighter. I make out that he was in prison at the time. Anyway, he was never seen again. Gertrude says they were all going on quite quietly, and the two children brought up like sisters. Mrs. Ensor had almost come to think, Gertrude says, that it was the other way about, and that the beautiful child was hers, and the wretched one the cook's. Gertrude didn't care. Her child was the gainer. But that the day Mr. Ensor came, Mrs. Ensor rushed into the kitchen like a mad thing, and said she'd told him Phyllis was hers, and Mary Gertrude's, and that was the way it had to be, for he was coming to live here. Doctor, what do you think of that?"
"I think, if it's true, it's a disgusting business. But I don't quite believe it."
"I do," said the nurse stoutly. "I am coming to believe it. That woman, Mrs. Ensor, is bad enough for anything, and she simply couldn't have had a nice, simple child like Phyllis, not if she tried ever so."
"There, he's gone,"
said Hodgson, leaving the window. He came to the bedside and surveyed the child's small body, lying straight, neatly, fairly disposed. The nurse stood proudly away from her work. "She looks nice now, doesn't she, doctor? I've put her on one of Miss Phyllis's smart nightgowns. Gertrude went into Mrs. Ensor's room and got it for me. She's not so bad, you know, Gertrude. She only did as she was told. Mrs. Ensor did the beating and wouldn't let her, positively wouldn't let her give the child nourishing food."
"How is Mrs. Ensor? Did you gather?"
"Quite calm, Gertrude says, though she knows everything."
"She's absolutely determined not to let herself have a miscarriage, that's about it," said Hodgson, buttoning his coat. "She's got plenty of self-control and courage of a kind."
"Courage, to be cruel," exclaimed the nurse, glancing at the human piece of wreckage on the bed. "And I should say that if she thinks it necessary to starve her children to death, if they happen to be born weaklings, that the chances are she'll have to kill the next, too, even if she does manage to get it born all right. And I have my doubts about that. She's far too keen about it, too."
"What's that?" Hodgson interrupted, cocking his ear.
Mrs. Ensor's door.
He's gone into her then.
They looked at each other.
Ensor, speaking urgently to his wife at the closed door of her room, anxious to impart some intelligence he had just received, could get no reply from her. He did not give it up, but continued to call her by her name, Adelaide. She had a pet name chosen by herself. He remembered it, but he could not bring himself to use it. Half an hour seemed to elapse. He heard a groan. Though he hated her, it frightened him, for there was no one with her. He changed the tenor of his appeals. Adelaide, if you are ill, you must not shut yourself up like this. You may do harm to yourself and to your child. If you won't see me, at least let me send Gertrude to you. Then she spoke. Wald, I am not very ill, not more ill than I expect to be, for I am going to have a child. It will not be quite yet. As soon as it is born, I shall kill myself, but not till then. So you need not be afraid. Her voice sounded fainter. She had turned away from the door. He was astonished at her self-control. Not more ill than I expect to be. He felt that he ought to see for himself how she was. Bitterly, dispassionately, he made the attempt. Let me see you then, he said gently, just for one moment. Is it to scold me? Her voice sounded close to the door. I am not to be scolded now. The key was turned in the lock and he made his way in. His wife stood there on the threshold, half defiant, half apologetic. As he knew Adelaide, the deprecation was much for her. Her beautiful, mournful eyes sought his. They held no cruel gleams, such as had lurked there so lately, when they had talked of Mary. Her dull black silk peignoir was gathered round her. She held it looped pathetically in one thin hand. Yet he was not moved. He only thought of her health, pathologically, as a doctor might. It was his duty. He had neglected his other duty lately. She put up her sharp chin. Her hand let slip the folds of black. They fell all round her, trailing. Kiss me, Wald, she said. No, I cannot. She turned and moved towards the sofa that stretched across the foot of her bed. Her stumble over the long, embarrassing folds of the garment she wore was a mute reproach, but it could not affect him to the extent of inducing him to comply with her request. She breathed heavily and sat down on the sofa. See Gertrude, then. She will tell you all you want to know. Your cook, Adelaide, tell me yourself. Oh, why? She rocked backwards and forwards and nursed her knees. I could not bear the sight of her, I tell you, she answered him passionately. She was a degenerate. She disgraced me. She wasn't fit to live. She ought never to have been born, never even have been conceived. But she shames her father, not me. I am a normal, healthy woman, and all disease is repugnant to me. It's a law. A law that was infringed. She pays the penalty. And to see her going about day by day, the living testimony of unfitness, of beastliness. Why, the sight of her peaked, suffering face, old and yellow, she looked like that even in her cradle. From the very first moment that Gertrude showed her to me, that finished me. For I insisted on seeing her at once. I was fit enough. I was about in a week. Then, when I came to look closer, her awful hand. Did you know that she had a finger less on her right hand? Still, I nursed her myself. She put her handkerchief to her bitten lips. There was blood on it when she took it away. Then, when you came, I saw you look at her in the car, and again when we got out. And you carried the rugs for her as we walked up the drive. That was enough. I made up my mind then, and I have never repented it. Never, never, I tell you. You would never have married me if you had known, for you would have the same ideas as me. Wald, that's what I liked in you, only I didn't know that you were a coward. A mean, canting, respectable, conventional coward.
what they used to call lily-livered, or is it pigeon-livered?
Sneer at me if you like, Adelaide, but explain, damn you, explain, he cried, forgetting himself, forgetting her state, forgetting everything under the stress of the terrible, nearly formulated horror.
What's there to explain, she said. I hated the child, and I beat her. I beat her to death, that's all.
He groaned in helplessness, overcome by her fierce self-sufficiency. But had you no sort of human feeling? No woman's tenderness? You've been a mother. There's surely such a thing as a mother's heart.
Adelaide looked at him wearily, shuddering.
Been a mother, yes. And you? What about your tenderness, your heart? We used to wonder that your heart didn't tell you when you heard her calling out, screaming, yelling. I beat her, I tell you. I beat her within an inch of her life, filthy, hateful object that I'd brought into the world through you. Pah!
She flung herself down. Her tone was so piercing, so foreign, so unknown to him, who had learned to expect every variation in Adelaide, that he cried in panic fear merely,
For God's sake, keep your head, Adelaide. Don't go mad now on top of it all.
Oh, I'm not mad, not a bit of it. Can't you see, you fool?
But no, you can't see. You can't see anything unless it's under your nose. It was under your nose. And you worried and worried, and yet you didn't see it. Here you are, Mary's your own child, and mine. Mine. Yours. Don't you remember that night? That night after Tristan?
No, I remember nothing. Be quiet now.
He held up his hand, as if to ward off a blow.
Where is she?
My God, I don't know. She fell back. Her pains had begun. He took no notice.
I'm going to Mary, he murmured.
She rushed forward and bolted the door behind him. The doctor and the nurse were still waiting by the body of Mary. Aware of the portentous visit of Inspector Kelson, Hodgson fancied he might be of some use. He might do Ensor a good turn in allocating much of the blame which the husband was so generously anxious to take on his own shoulders, onto the wife's where it belonged. There were reasons why she should be better able to bear it than he. The law would be merciful to her in her then condition. Hodgson could not fathom her. He was merely an overworked, overdriven country doctor, riding about daily from one case to another. That the maladies of the hardy, normal, if worn-out wives of the laboring classes were of a painful and dreary similarity, and completely relieved him of the necessity of keeping himself up to date with the new departures in medicine, was perhaps the reason that he did not break down from obvious overwork. His old mare, who carried her sleeping master on her back along the same old roads to the same old cottages to attend to Hodge's same wife's seventh baby, was as well preserved as he. A complicated, abnormal case like Mrs. Ensor's, circumstances so dramatic as this affair at High Walls, seldom or never came his way. And events in this house had in the last 24 hours succeeded each other with such a bewildering rapidity that he felt himself excused from keeping up too rigid an attitude with the nurse, who, like himself, was humanly and professionally interested, and he permitted himself a certain relaxation in talking to her. Nurse Ferrier, on the other hand, having been shut up in High Walls for many days under the rigorous rule of Adelaide, was enjoying herself thoroughly. All the while that Ensor was closeted with Mrs. Ensor, she continued freely to develop her physiological views, leaving the room only for a moment to get some white flowers to lay upon the child's breast. They heard voices from the next room, and her open and his professionally concealed curiosity was wrought up to the highest pitch when suddenly these voices ceased and they heard the click of a latch and a step in the corridor. Then the door of the room they were in was opened with deliberation, and the hero of their surmises and of their sympathy walked into the room. He did not really seem to see them,
as they observed afterwards, although he moved his head slightly as he passed the doctor and made what might pass as a grunt of recognition. His politeness survived in the overthrow of all his standards and hopes and ambitions. They stood humbly aside. It was his hour. No one, so far as they knew, had told him that Mary was dead, but he could not help knowing it when his eyes had rested for a moment on what lay on the bed. At a sign from Hodgson, the nurse left the room. The doctor followed her. The two stood in the corridor outside, looking nervously, now at that door of the room they had just vacated, now at that which gave admittance to Mrs. Ensor's apartments, whence came no sound of stirring. 5 minutes later, Wald Ensor came out of the bedroom, carrying the body of the child in his arms very carefully. As he passed his wife's door with his burden, it was opened sharply and as suddenly closed again. Mrs. Ensor had looked out. Hodgson and Ferrier followed Ensor downstairs, wondering what he was going to do, afraid that he had gone suddenly mad and that they would have to interfere. But so far he was perfectly quiet, restrained, and measured in his movements. He walked steadily, balancing what he carried as a nurse does a baby, down into the hall where the autumn fire leaped on the hearth and the charred logs tinkled as they fell. He went through it into the portion railed off with screens and armchairs and, stooping, deposited the corpse of his child on the tiger skin which lay spread over the sofa, the old yellow sofa from Portland Place. The creases were in the skin that his wife had made when she was lying there only yesterday. Her bag, one of her bags, lay on it, and with a violent gesture of his occupied hand, Ensor swept it off. Then, deliberately, as if he were in church, he knelt down beside the little white-robed form, smoothed the folds of the nightgown his hands had disarrayed, and half-raising her, taking her in his arms, covered her with kisses, long and deep. He did not lift his head when Gertrude, her apron cast aside, a puzzling figure with her unaccustomed black surfaces displayed, pushed open the red baize door and stood, savagely poised, her bony, flowery arms resting on her hips. "Go back," the doctor said in a loud whisper. Gertrude paid no heed. Her dull, faithful eyes were raised, fixed on something she saw at the head of the staircase. It was her mistress, who was even now descending. The nurse darted forward, and in so doing, her dress caught in an accidental nail in one of the screens and made it fall over the end of the couch. Wald Ensor looked up. He kept hold of the child's hand. Adelaide continued to descend. Gertrude went a step to meet her, but Adelaide waved her away. Then Ensor rose, for Adelaide had reached the bottom of the staircase and was coming to him and Mary. She tottered, but she came on. Her husband raised his finger and pointed it at her, and she ceased, trembling, to advance. Gertrude strode up to her and held her shoulder. Her state was obvious. She no longer took pains to conceal it. "Listen, all of you," Ensor was saying, in the same gloomy, intent voice he had used all day. "I pray to Almighty God that this woman may never live to bear another child." He stayed for the inquiry into the death of Mary. He bore himself like a man. Then he left England, and his wife never saw him again. She survived the birth of her child, stillborn. The end. End of section 16. End of Tales of the Uneasy by Violet Hunt.